been spending some time at Eugene Country Club, not as a greenskeeper. You can find his coverage for this event and all the work he does in the Register Guard Sports section. Become a follower on Twitter. Use the handle at AustinMeekRG. Austin, good day out there. Nice to have you in, as always. How you doing?
Good, Stephen. You know I'm not out there as a golfer, right?
Yeah, from what I understand, towels have been thrown in on your behalf. So none of the golfers were out there asking where they should land their tee shot or on the approach on the green. Not a lot of advice being sought by you?
They were not consulting me on that, no. I would not be the person to ask.
All right. So we know the Oregon women's golf team qualified for the NCAAs. Let's get to yesterday. In essence, the quarterfinals is what we would refer to as the Elite Eight, the match play, which I absolutely love as a former competitive golfer. But Caroline Inglis, now a senior, of course, went to Churchill, shot 65 on Saturday. How much attention has there been on the local star? And maybe with a 77 yesterday, she feeling the heat a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, look, college golf is not really a spectator sport. I don't know a lot of people who spend much time watching college golf. When I'm off the clock, I'm probably not watching a lot of college golf. But I'll tell you, when you're out there and you see it in person, it's pretty impressive. These girls are really, really good. You know, the impressive part for me is how accurate they are. I've been walking with Caroline Inglis a lot this week. I can probably count on one hand the number of drives I've seen go out of the fairway. You know, so it's been pretty impressive to watch Caroline and the other girls play. And there's been, you know, not huge crowds, but there's been a gallery every day walking around with the Oregon players. It's been kind of a cool event. And Oregon was a great story. They got knocked out this morning, so they're done. But for them to make the Final Eight and get into match play was a great story. Tournament kind of needed an angle like that, kind of needed the hometown team to have a good week, and they did have a good week. So it's been kind of a fun event, even for somebody like me who is not necessarily a big fan of college golf in general.
Now, as you wrote about today, as things wound down yesterday, you know, the Ducks were the team in the proverbial clubhouse, and it's kind of cold-hearted because you got to kind of hope the team behind you doesn't pass you. I guess you can call it the golf version of the bubble. How close did they come to not making the quarters? And from the coaches and players you spoke with, you know, what were some of the emotions they were feeling?
Well, that was probably the best drama of the week so far. It was last night, waiting to see who would get that last spot in match play. It looked like Oregon had just completely choked it away. They had, I think, three bogeys on number 18 to drop them out of that number 8 spot. And Oklahoma State had a one-stroke lead on them coming down the number 18 fairway. And then the Oklahoma State girl just completely blew up on the last green. Hit her shot in the bunker, then went over the green into another bunker, then back over the green into the original bunker. So that was pretty high drama with the Oregon team lined up watching this happen. You feel for that girl from Oklahoma State because anybody who's ever picked up a golf club has been there. To have that happen on number 18 when you just need a par to get that last spot, I'm sure it was very devastating for her, but it was great drama, and it was what ended up putting Oregon into the match play.
Yeah, some of that could be cringeworthy as we continue with Austin Meek of the Register Guard. On Sunday, you wrote about football head injuries involving an Oregon coach. It happened to be a story from 45 years ago. And at the center, first the coach, then Jerry Fry, a former player who many of us know around here from his days at Thurston and Marist, Don Stone. What did you learn about Coach Stone, his experience with this now high-profile issue, and how his former coach handled it?
Well, this is a really complicated story. We could probably spend all hour talking about this because there's a lot of layers to it, and maybe in a minute we can talk about the other concussion story that's out there with the NFL allegedly influencing the research being done on head injuries. But this story, the genesis of it, is a guy who filed a lawsuit against the NCAA and the Pac-12 regarding head injuries, former Oregon player who, frankly, nobody had ever heard of. When this lawsuit came out last week, everybody was sort of scratching their heads and saying, who is this guy named Daniel Cook, who supposedly played from 1971 to 1973, that filed this lawsuit? So I was the one who wrote just a short story for our website summarizing this lawsuit. And this guy who says he played from 71 to 73 had like 15 to 30 concussions.
Whoa.
And now apparently has really debilitating dementia as a result. So I wrote this story, and the next day I heard from Terry Fry, who is Jerry Fry's son, the sports writer in Denver.
Yeah, he's an author, right.
Frankly, Terry was not very happy with me or the story, because he was adamant that this guy did not play for my dad. Nobody's heard of this guy. He's not on any rosters. And he's saying that this happened in 1971, which was Jerry Fry's last year, and I don't think he played for my dad.
Wow.
And then I heard from Don Stone, who played in that era, who was also on the team. I heard from another teammate who didn't remember this guy at all, and who had very different stories about Jerry Fry kind of being ahead of his time with head injuries. So to condense a really long story here, turns out this guy, this Daniel Cook, didn't play in 1971. He didn't play till 1978, and the dates in the lawsuit were incorrect. And I think the reason is, you know, this guy has dementia, and his memory of that time is just not really intact. So that opens up a whole other can of worms with this head injury thing. Just a really, really complicated story.
So of what we can document, though, you talked about being ahead of his time back 45 years ago. Apparently, Coach Fry was actually taking the stand you would want every single solitary coach who's overseeing young men to take.
Yeah, and this was a story that really made me think about, you know, some of the biases or suppositions that I bring into this concussion thing, because I think people are tempted to see it really black and white. Like, you know, there's all these players who played football in the 60s and 70s who now are having really severe health issues as a result of concussions. And so these guys are the victims, and the bad guys in the story are the NFL and the NCAA and the coaches at that time who were maybe willfully ignorant about head injuries.
Right.
But then you hear stories about guys like Jerry Fry, who, according to the two players that I talked to from that era, was very conscious about head injuries and told these guys who had concussions, hey, we're not going to risk your long-term health to let you go out there and play after you've had these head injuries. We'll keep you on scholarship, but we're not going to let you play, which I think for that time was a really progressive stance to have on head injuries. So it's not all black and white. It's not like all the coaches back then didn't care about head injuries, weren't concerned about the long-term health of their players, were totally ignorant. It's not true at all. Not all of them. Some of them probably were, but certainly not all of them.
Well, along those lines, like I said, that was 1971 with that information available. That was one coach overseeing 85 to 100 guys. And now this story about Roger Goodell and the NFL comes out about trying to maybe influence a scientific study that they initially agreed to fund. I don't know, at a basic level, you know, it kind of reminds me, I just saw that movie, The Big Short, about the housing bubble. People with all this authority kind of just dump on people's lives for profit. When you read this stuff, initially, does it ignite that anger in you that it obviously has in me?
Well, it just makes you sick to read about some of this stuff. And the whole thing with the concussion story for me is trying to figure out, okay, who's the bad guy in all of this? Who do you blame? You know,
right.
Who's the person who is willfully covering up information, who knows the risk but is trying to hide the risk for the sake of preserving the game. You know, who's that person? And it certainly looks like Roger Goodell right now is that person who knows the risks and is working behind the scenes to influence the science and cover this up. So, yeah, you know, it's just the whole thing is so complicated, and there's so many layers to it. But, yeah, what I've wrestled with in writing that column and in thinking about this, you know, absolutely I support any football player who played football really in any era, but especially, you know, 30, 40 years ago before this stuff was really talked about in a mainstream way. I support any football player who wants to exercise his legal right to try to get some compensation for what's happened to his brain. I think that's, you know, I think that's perfectly within anybody's right to do that. But I also, you know, I see the side of it too from somebody like Terry Fry, who's saying, "Hey, my dad's getting thrown under the bus, and don't lump my dad in with Roger Goodell or somebody else who was willfully trying to cover this up." So it's definitely two sides to it, but the NFL thing really just turned my stomach because it supports everything that people already think about the NFL, which is that ultimately they're interested in making money and sustaining their business and not in protecting their players. Really, their only interest in protecting their players is giving the impression that they are. But then publicly they say one thing, and behind the scenes they do something very different.
No, this has been, I believe, stomach-turning. What you said is kind of accurate here. Let's move on to what we learned today. The Pac-12 is going to work with their network partners, ESPN and Fox, reduce the number of football games that start after 7. We've heard coaches and players talk about it. We've heard fans and media address this. But first of all, this amount of games they're talking about doesn't seem like it's that substantial, but maybe considering fans in other time zones, media in other time zones, fans who have to travel far to make games, maybe at least a step in the right direction?
I'm with you. I'm going to hold off on the parade here until we know actually how many games this is going to involve. Because if you read the fine print, it said as many as 4, which could mean 4 or 3 or 2 or 1 or 0. So let's wait and see where it is on that spectrum before we get too excited about it. It kind of sounds to me like the Pac-12 wanted the headline that they're going to have fewer late games. But the basis of the TV contract isn't going to change. ESPN and Fox are still going to, they're still going to have all the late games that they had last year. It's just, looks like a pretty small number of games on the Pac-12 network that this is going to affect. And yeah, it is a step in the right direction. And if, you know, if your school has one game that starts at 6 p.m. instead of 7:30, that's, you know, it's not nothing. You're happy about that. I'm certainly happy about that if I get another hour and a half on deadline one Saturday next fall. But I don't see it as being, you know, a huge solution to the problem, or probably, frankly, anything that the average fan is going to notice.
Yeah, it seems minimal impact at this point. Final thought. The other piece in the story is about storming the court, rushing the field, now no longer frowned upon. $25,000 for a first offense, doubles to $50,000 for a second, doubles again to $100,000 for the third. I'm not totally on board here, but you hear this, whether they're talking about logic, safety. What's your initial reaction upon hearing this?
Well, has any fan who's contemplating rushing the court ever decided, I'm not going to do this because I don't want my school to pay a fine? I don't think that's part of the thought process if you're a fan who's going to rush the court. So I don't know. I'd have to see some research on whether these fines actually are a successful deterrent to people rushing the court, or if it's just, you know, a way to make the conference some extra money. I don't know. I mean, yeah, is it dangerous? It is. I've seen examples in the last 2 years where a court storming almost resulted in something really catastrophic. There was a sports writer in Iowa last year who got his leg broken in a court storming. So it is dangerous, and I do think something needs to be done to make it, if not eliminate it, at least make it safer. But I just don't know if imposing a fine is really going to have that much impact on whether fans do it or not.
Yeah, I don't notice the pit crew having a quick meeting whether determining to storm the court in an ESPN game. All right, that's a wrap. Follow this guy on Twitter, at AustinMeekRG. Pick up the paper, registerguard.com. Always appreciate the time, Austin. Have a great week.
All right, thanks, Steve. You too.
All right, take it easy.